to the Investor Coaching Show. Paul Winkler here talking about the world of money and investing. Yeah, that's, of course, what we'll be talking about. And I've got a friend with me, Mr. Tony Bouquet from the American College, long-term friend. And Tony, man, good to see you. We hardly ever, you walk in, we hardly have a chance to talk. Like, you're talking about this, that, and the other thing.
I know. We got to catch up all the time.
I know. It's like getting reacquainted for the first 10 minutes and going, oh gosh, what have you been up to, man? but Tony works in the American College. So you just know what that is American College is one of the universities, one of the few universities that does, well, they're still number one in all the education for the CFP and Certified Financial
Correct.
Planner and Chartered Financial Consultant, of course, is their designation,
right.
Which are basically sister designations, although don't tell CFPs that. Did I say that out loud?
It's true.
I mean, it's just same educational work. And you know, it's just, you know, it. And here, okay, so this was not on the agenda, but, you know, the thing to me that I find so fascinating is that in most fields, like, for example, medical fields, you can go get a medical degree and become a doctor, a medical doctor at dozens, hundreds of colleges and that have medical programs around the country. I don't know how many there are, actually, but there've got to be a lot of them. And a couple of them here, right here in Middle Tennessee, a few anyway. I don't know how many. But why is it that you don't have that many that are teaching in the financial world, and then you have just one designation to become a medical doctor?
Right.
And why so many designations in the financial world?
That's a good question. And we try to keep the designation count down in the industry, in the profession, mm-hmm. because we don't want to confuse the buying public.
Mm-hmm. You guys do a great job. I'm just going to tell you, I love the college. You know, somebody was here from the college the other day, and we got into a long conversation. And the thing that I find, people ask me, okay, so what are all this alphabet soup after your name? Well, each of them, number one, CFP, make sure you're working with Certified Financial Planner or Chartered Financial Consultant. Either one of those, and then there's Personal Financial Specialist, which is a good one as well. But typically CPAs get that one,
right.
So it's a little bit different in its approach. But in essence, those designations are really good. And then the other ones, I love the Wealth Management Certified Professional designation. I don't know how much you've been involved in that or seen what that is, but what I love about that designation, so this is another one, folks, that I tell people, advisors ought to have this. If you're an advisor listening, go get this designation. It's really good. Because what it does that none of the other, even the CFP, CHFC, none of the financial planning designations do, is it gets more into the academic research on investing, really heavily into it. And you guys have done, so talk to whoever at the college, tell them I love what they've done there.
Well, you interviewed Michael Finke, I believe, and
yeah.
He's the mastermind of it.
So. Right. Well, I think he and I talked more about the RICP, which I love
too.
As well.
Yeah.
That was phenomenal.
Yeah.
But if he ever wants to talk about the Wealth Management Certified Professional, I would
always ready.
Get him on the show. Well, then let him know.
Him okay. And Wade Fowle. You know Wade Fowle.
Right, of course. Yeah,
so Dr.
absolutely.
Fowle too,
yeah. He and I have had conversations before. So, look, you wrote an article for the college. And, you know, what I want to do is I want to talk with you about this, because this is something that is really big with younger people right now, using robotic portfolios. I talk a lot about target date funds. I don't see much difference between the two of them in that, you know, it's just the fund company is choosing the mutual funds in the target date funds, the robotic portfolio. They're set up by robots actually choosing your investments and supposedly coming up with an asset allocation. And asset allocation drives 91 to 94% of your returns of your investment portfolio. So, folks, this is really, really important. We're talking 91 to 94% of your investment performance driven by how your portfolio is allocated. And one of the big things right now is that younger people just blatantly, just blindly trust computers.
They do.
And they're just really, really enamored with the idea of, why don't I just have this through a computer and then I don't have to deal with anybody? It's, you know, in reality, I don't know, is it just, it's kind of like the phone generation does not want to actually engage with people. I'm not sure what that is, why it is that they avoid people, but the reality of it is that they are avoiding people, and they're scared. I get it. You know, they're scared of being taken advantage of. They've seen their parents taken advantage of, grandparents being taken advantage of. They've heard the horror stories. You hear about 2008, the market downturns, and the horror stories that happened then. And of course, you know, this newfangled robotic thing is going to help protect me against that. Of course, it will not. But it's the belief that they do. But you bring up an interesting point in your article that I don't never really thought about. It's ethics.
Right.
In regards to ethics and in these investment portfolios, and something that people are not thinking about regarding this. So what is it? Walk through. What was the ethical issue?
Well, you can hold people accountable for ethical practice. It's ethics, morals is a human construct. Mm-hmm. So, but machines, who do you hold responsible? Do you hold responsible the software companies that build the software for this artificial
I lost a bunch of money, and who's
ethically responsible?
Right.
Not necessarily legally responsible, because that could be two different questions. Because, you know, something can be legal and be unethical at the same time.
Oh, that's an interesting idea.
So they could legally be fine, but where's the ethics component?
So when you say they could be legally okay, so you can't sue them, but what would be the ethical when you say, so is because they're unethical, is there some other type of issue at stake here? I'm not sure what...
It could be. You could hold... a person can wrong you ethically, and you have no legal recourse. But do you want your friends dealing with that in the future?
Got it. So you know what? You know, this is really interesting, Tony, because this is something I've talked about here on the show before. A lot of the fiduciary rule talk that has been going on for the past 10 years is the idea that we must keep financial advisors, must keep clients' best interest first making recommendations.
Right.
And the problem that, you know, there was a study that was done in Indiana University, University of Southern California, was that where they actually found that the investment advisors were making the same mistakes with their own portfolios that they were their clients. So the issue was, do they know enough to actually hold people's best interest first? But let's say that they do. Let's say that you have a group of people that does. And we can hold them accountable. Maybe do something like what Europe is doing, where you have, for example, it is Great Britain, Australia. Number one, you cannot give financial advice and receive a commission. That's number one. The other thing that's actually happening over there is that you must have, they're giving them about 4 to 5 years for everybody that's in the financial field to get a financial planning degree. They must have a degree.
That's good.
So they're forcing them to get educated so that they don't have an excuse to say, well, I just didn't know, or you know, be able to come out and say, oh, I was just ignorant. Now, here's the issue. They are being held accountable. The fund companies, meanwhile, and some of these fund companies are eclipsing the investment advisor world in assets under management and bringing on new assets under management, where people are purportedly, you know, they call it doing it themselves, but in reality, the fund company is managing their money.
Right.
And I say that's a misnomer. The fund companies, it seems to me, are getting off scot-free, being able to not have any kind of standard because they are simply offering a product.
That's correct. And legally, they're doing nothing wrong.
And so it would be the same thing.
Yeah.
It seems to me.
It could be.
That they're doing something that, and you know, I never really thought about that, but that's the ethical issue. So you have, you know, you're talking about situations here. You said, let's ponder some of the relevant situations and questions they give rise to. In the case of healthcare, you use healthcare here, which I like, is practitioners of today are using computers and robots in addition to their own personal skills. So they're using it as a tool. And they're using their judgment because the computer's just going to spit out something.
Correct.
And then the professional is going to make a judgment as to whether that applies. Is that the issue that you're dealing with?
That's correct. And, you know, more and more of these computers, these robots, are being worked in the way that they eventually will make decisions, more and more decisions, for the operator.
Oh.
So... yeah, where will that go, and where will the ethics lie in that? right now you make an ethical decision where anybody that you deal with, you want to deal legally with. Mm-hmm. And the legality most every advisor follows.
Mm-hmm.
Legally, they have to do
right.
certain things.
Yeah, or they're out of the business, yeah.
Yeah, but they may do it legally, but still not be holding the client's best interest at heart in a way that it's unethical. It's an unethical decision.
And you talk about that in here, that, you know, the human, the person that's, when you're dealing with a human, they're dealing with emotions. They understand they've been where you are before.
That's correct.
So that they can actually walk you through a decision. Because I think about when I'm guiding people, you know, when markets go down. I've been there. I remember in 1999, everybody was bulletproof. And then you get into the year 2000, 2001, and you're watching things go down. And I saw people come in and say, I can't retire now. You know, it's because they had gotten caught up in the tech bubble.
Exactly.
And they wouldn't say, I heard you on the radio. And it seems like you're not having some of the same issues that I am. And I said, yeah, because it was level of diversification. But now, basically, I've got to build this portfolio from the bottom because they lost so much money in technology. And now you're talking to this person on an emotional level, and maybe they're talking about a loss of a husband, a loss of a job or something going on with their family. And you're looking at a whole dynamic that you have to guide them that in a way that the computer would not say, that would be the best way to guide them.
Exactly.
But because of emotionally what they're going through, like I think of an example yesterday. I was talking to a lady that her husband passed away. And she and I got to talking, and she says, I haven't done anything. I have not done anything with my finances whatsoever. And I said, look, I said, it's only been a year. You know, you haven't done anything. That's fine until you're emotionally ready to do something. Whereas maybe, you know, the computer is going to just be, you know, do this, do that, do that, and the other thing, and she's not ready.
Right. Do it now. And it may be legally right to do it now.
Right.
But she may not be ready for that.
Yeah.
Emotionally.
Well, emotions are such a big deal when it comes to investing, because I want to go away from pain. I want to go toward pleasure. And the reality of it is that those emotions drive the bus on so many different levels. And risk tolerance comes into that.
Yes.
Talk about risk tolerance with investors. And what I know the college has done some work on this area.
We have. Plenty. And risk tolerance goes back to the question of how will they deal with this emotionally?
Mm-hmm.
Because their risk tolerance is their behavioral finance. Everyone has a behavioral finance element in their emotions. I take more risk when I'm young than when I'm older. Just emotionally, physically, everything.
And the other thing you have to be conscious of is some people take more risk after market upturns.
That's true.
So the reality of it is the advisor can walk in there and go, hey, look, you're wanting to, and I've done this with many people, you're wanting to take a bunch of risk. You're wanting to step out there and hit it out of the park right now. But I'm telling you something, you're feeling bulletproof, not because you have risk capacity.
Right.
You have the ability to take risk.
That's right. And when they get hit, if they take a hit after that emotional, in a bad emotional state, what will it do for them in the future?
Yeah.
They're going to be even deeper in an emotional crisis, not knowing what to do and when to do it.
And they won't take the risk when they should.
That's right.
Yeah, and that's the reality
of
it. And
we're building that. By not being ethically in tune with them,
mm-hmm.
we can do that. We could end up hurting them more than helping them.
So in the robotic portfolio, basically what we're talking about, younger people are going, I have no idea what you guys are talking about. When you're going through a risk tolerance questionnaire, let me tell you what it looks like. If you went through a 20% downturn in your investment portfolio, would you, A, put more money in? Would you, B, just do nothing? Or, C, would you pull your money out of the market? it might ask a question like that. It might be something to that degree. Now, what if the portfolio downturn were 30%? Would you A, put more money in your investment portfolio, B, do nothing, C, take money out? So they're trying to get an idea of what your risk tolerance, what your tolerance for risk is. Could I handle a 20% loss? Could I handle a 30% loss is what they're looking for here. The problem that you run into is that let's say that you have a 10% downturn in the market and you are taking this test. And it is saying, what if you had a 20% downturn? Would you A? Now, we've got to realize what comes along with that 10% downturn, folks. A lot of headlines telling you why the market just turned down and why things are going to get worse. Because the market's a leading economic indicator. It goes down in anticipation of the bad events. The media may be telling you that bad stuff is coming, but the reality is the market has already priced it in. Now what you got going on here, and what Tony's saying, is you could have a situation where all of a sudden you're going through this risk tolerance questionnaire and you're totally risk intolerant after a market downturn. Now, conversely, recently we have seen a decent run-up in large U.S. stocks. We see the Dow's hitting record levels. Everybody's talking about it's hitting record levels. And we're talking about the NASDAQ hitting record levels. We're talking about the S&P 500 net record, you know, and that's just one area of the market. It's just a small area of the market because you've got small value companies and all of that. But here's the issue. After a market upturn, you're going, man, I could get rich. And now this is where a robotic advisor is giving you some kind of risk tolerance questionnaire, and you're saying, after a market downturn of 20%, what would you do? And I'm like, heck, it ain't going to turn down ever. It's going to go up forever.
You downplay it.
You downplay it. Is exactly what you do. Yeah. And then all of a sudden, your risk tolerance is bulletproof. And then you go and put money in, and the risk tolerance question, there's a legality. Yep. They followed the legal rules, didn't they?
They did.
I asked you what your risk tolerance was. You told me bulletproof. And just because you lost a bunch of money, well, where's the ethics?
Right.
There's the ethics right there.
And a good human advisor
right.
will learn more about the background of the individual. Mm-hmm. Know, for instance, they suffered a loss, a death in the family.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe had to go to work at a very young age.
Mm-hmm.
All of these things have built emotions into the client that no computer program will ever be able to understand.
And the other thing is that the advisor should do is find out what level of confidence the person has in their career and talk to them a little bit about their history of job changes. You know, do they, when they lose jobs, are they looking for another job for a month or a year or, you know, 2 years, or are they in a difficult to get a new job type of a career field?
Yeah,
you know, maybe there are limited numbers of jobs. Maybe they're going to have to move. That will be a cost, and of course, that will affect your risk tolerance. You know, where
greatly, yeah,
and
greatly.
And another example might be how affected are you by the economy? Are you in a cyclical industry? If you're in a cyclical industry, and all of a sudden you're out of a job because the market cycle has gone against you, well, that will be exactly the same time that what will be down?
Right.
The market. And that's why you probably need to have less aggressive asset management in your portfolio, simply because of the fact that you may need it at a time when stocks will be down. And you have to think in terms of that, and that may change the amount of emergency fund that you need to have. A lot of things in here, aren't there?
And you and I have been around a while, Paul. We've seen, mm-hmm. I've seen hundreds of risk tolerance questions, but none of them touched on the two that you just mentioned. It's only a professional that knows the dynamics of what goes into this decision can understand the kind of questions we have to ask.
Yeah, it's risk capacity.
It is.
Yeah, exactly. And he also says it was Social Security programs. I was thinking about this with Social Security programs. And a lot of times you with Social Security programs, you talk about a program. Now, here is a computer program, and the idea being that I can come in and you can come in, and they're advertised to the public. Come on in, do a Social Security analysis. You know, people are losing a lot of their benefits. You need to come in and sit down. And they're going to run you through a program, and this is stuff that's getting increasingly available on the internet as well. And what you really have to be careful about regarding this is, you know, sometimes the advisors know the input assumptions. They know how these things work. Sometimes they're using it as a sales tool in reality. There are some programs out there that are selling workshops, Social Security workshops, and there are designations out there. And the whole purpose behind the, not by American College, by the way, but there are outside designations in other places that they're using it, and they're using it as a lead generation tool. Now, what can happen, and this is related to any type of computer programming or any type of computer advice that you might get, is you have a lot of assumptions, and it's garbage in, garbage out, folks. When you're dealing with Social Security, make sure that you know that life expectancies that the computer program is assuming for both a husband and a wife, you know, or if it's just yourself by yourself, what the life expectancy is that the program is assuming for you. Lost opportunity costs. When they're telling you to take Social Security early, you know, you may have somebody actually says, well, you ought to take it at this particular age. And the reality it is why the computer program kicked off that it made sense for you to take it at that earlier age is because the lost opportunity cost or the rate of return being assumed on investments that you would make in lieu of putting off your Social Security, that you would be keeping more money in investments, they may be assuming a rate of return on your investments that's way higher than what's practical.
Reasonable, right? Mm-hmm.
And COLAs, cost of living allowances. Yep. You know, 2% is what the Fed Reserve target is for cost of living. Social Security is based on the labor inflation rate. You got to think about death order assumptions. You know, who is going to possibly pass away first? What assumptions are being used in your software program? Not something that a computer program is necessarily going to do. And a lot of programs, I've noticed this, is that they ignore tax data altogether. They ignore income taxes on Social Security benefits, and they also ignore the penalties for working prior to your full retirement age. So you got to think about that. So this is a lot of, so you've been talking around the country about this kind of stuff to people?
I have. I do an article a month for this magazine, mm-hmm. and it's amazing to me that, you know, and I'm not trying to tell your audience not to pay attention to software packages that are out there. There's good software packages that they should use and they could use that isn't going to be an issue for
Absolutely.
Them. So it's not to scare them, it's to protect the client. We need to always be thinking ahead, where will this leave us ethically and morally in the future? Yeah. Right now, when we say somebody did something unethical, it's a person doing that. Mm-hmm. In the future, that may not be the case.
And that could be very dangerous for the investing public. You're listening to the Investor Coaching Show right here on Supertalk 99.7 WTN. I'm here with my friend Tony Bouquet from American College Financial Services. We'll be back right after this. Here, Investor Coaching Show. Paul Winkler, along with my friend Tony Bouquet from the American College of Financial Services, hanging out here with me today in the studio, talking about the world of ethics right now. We're talking about robotic portfolios, the issues with robotics portfolios. How do you keep a robot ethical? I don't. Is there a joke there? No, maybe not.
That might be.
If we had long enough to think about it, we might be able to come up with. So even you go around the country and you talk about this stuff. Talk a little bit more about that. And what do you talk about to groups? And how is it received? And what happens there?
Well, we're an industry based on ethics. I mean, financial services. Most people don't look at the prospectus. They don't read the prospectus that you leave them. You know that. I know that. Mm-hmm. They don't read their life insurance policies, their car insurance policies.
Sure.
They don't.
Yeah.
So they rely on us.
Right.
And not only living up to the legal aspects, but the ethical and moral aspects. I am ethically responsible to make sure they understand what I'm offering them. I'm mm-hmm. ethically bound to that. Mm-hmm. Not just legally, it's like you mentioned the best interests of the client. Well, I'm forced to do that through ethics. Mm-hmm. If I'm an ethical person, I want to treat them the way I want to be treated. And, you know, not ignoring the truths that are out there. There's a true way of doing business, and then there's ways to cut the corners. Ethics always lies on the truth.
Are you getting some traction? Now, I know one of the things that you're doing is going around the country and talking to financial firms and trying to convince them that they need to send their advisors into financial planning classes and
get educated. Yes.
Is that working?
It is. It is.
Yay.
Yeah,
good.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. A man with many, many degrees and designations.
Yeah, I think that is just phenomenal. I remember talking to people in the financial services industry when they'd set up these booths at, you know, downtown at the convention center. Yeah. And I would walk around and I would stop, and yeah, I was in civilian clothes, and I would walk and say, hey, so what do you do? And what kind of education do you have? And they, well, I'll never forget one guy just basically telling me flat out, I don't have any of those designations. They just call us trailer park financial planners.
Oh, my goodness.
And I couldn't believe he actually said that.
I'm shocked. Yeah.
And my comment to him was, I said, buddy, I said, look, I said, you owe it to your clients.
They do.
And I know that some of the big investment firms that shall remain nameless are actually talking about not letting their advisors use the designations because they don't want to be fiduciaries. And the CFP, for example, requires that you be a fiduciary.
Correct.
And they're actually telling them, don't use the designation. Is any headway there?
Well,
I mean, that's just crazy.
It sounds crazy on the front end, but you have to come. They believe that they're doing the best interest for the client, regardless of a fiduciary level of standard. In other words, as a fiduciary, if I'm going to act on your behalf, I have to know everything you know mm-hmm. about yourself. Not every client's willing to do that.
So you think that they actually have that? That's the level that's being pushed?
That's the level that they're pushing.
Really?
For a fiduciary, I have to act in your best interest.
Right.
That means I have to know what you know about yourself.
Right.
I've dealt with clients for years. Clients don't always share all of their information.
Well, are you saying the law wouldn't be lenient if a client just simply wouldn't give information?
Again, that's legally,
yeah.
I don't know.
So you don't know, okay.
You know, I'm not an attorney.
So that makes more sense in light of that. That's fascinating.
So where do you draw that line?
Yeah.
You know, because if I'm going to be a fiduciary, means I have to do an extensive fact finder.
Right.
Maybe a sale of a insurance product, I don't need to know everything.
From what I saw, it was just the fiduciaries and stand in terms of making sure that the, you know, like from a cost standpoint, if there were better, you know, like when you're dealing with costs of different products and things like that, it would be, you know, like A shares versus C shares versus B shares and things like that. And they would say
that's a component.
That's a component, but it went even deeper than that. Wow.
The fiduciary.
So the government could really mess stuff up, couldn't they?
They can. They can. they do it regularly. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. It's just like nothing like coming in. Well, it just reminds me of that article we were talking about a little bit earlier with the insurance companies over in Europe and the insurers, the commissioners over there trying to force their rules on the United States.
Right.
And what a mess that would be. And
that
I
would
guess
be messy.
I'm not necessarily in a position to talk about this, folks, but if our government decides to just lay down and take some of these European rules, it could really mess up the insurance industry from a standpoint of, and you know, as anybody out there listening to me knows, I'm not a big fan of annuities as an accumulation vehicle, but they are a worthy distribution vehicle for some people. And if we end up in a situation where we're taking on European rules, it could ruin even that. And then you have that and life insurance costs going up. You have property and casualty rates going up if that happens. And you know, I think that's why it's really important for people to be politically aware of what's going on as far as what their legislators are doing from a standpoint of voting on legislation that will affect their entire lives. I mean, when you're looking at regulation, you can say, hey, regulation's great, they're going to protect me. But in the reality is that there is no such thing as a risk-free life. You know, when I try to live my life totally without risk, and I try to get somebody to protect me like the federal government, watch out for your wallet, because your wallet is going out the door, and you're actually going to be taking on risk because of the fact that you can't protect people from every eventuality. And this whole thing about the insurance industry right now is they're looking at treating it like the banking industry over in Europe. That'd be something else to watch. Hopefully it doesn't ever go there. All right, you listening to the Investor Coach? Let's talk about something ethics. This is really interesting. Google is coming under fire from the Wall Street Journal, and it has to do with how the search engine works. Fascinating. And it has investment return implications that I never dreamt of. So, you know, let's talk a little bit about that as well right after this. You're listening to the Investor Coaching Show right here on Super Talk 99.7 WTN. Along with Tony Bouquet from the American College of Financial Services, hanging out talking about, well, all kinds of stuff right now. So this is fascinating, Tony. So Google, big thing, and I'm talking about a thick article, folks, and if you want to read this for yourself, it's interesting. Wall Street Journal did an investigation, and it was on how Google interferes with its search algorithms, and I've had a lot of people, I don't know about you, but I get a lot of people from, Paul, what are you calling, pulling up something on Google for? Go use, and I'm gonna, what is it? DuckDuckGo. I drew a blank. Go use DuckDuckGo. Get to do that for a search engine, or go use Bing or whatever. You know, it's just like, don't use Google. And I'm like, I'm just gonna use Google. It's just easy. And I'm lazy. No, I'm not lazy, but
You're far from lazy. You're far from lazy.
But they are. They're very, very, very animated, let me just say, regarding this issue. Now, it says every minute an estimated 3, and I'm not alone, every minute an estimated 3.8 million queries are typed into Google, prompting its algorithms to spit out results for hotel rates, breast cancer treatments, and the latest news about President Trump. And they're basically said, this is the most powerful lines of computer code in the global economy. This is a big deal, and it can be billions of dollars of commerce when we're talking about the effect of these Google search. When you're looking for something, you're looking for a product, you're looking for information on a product, you're looking to do something, you're looking to buy something, you're looking to change something, you're looking to fix something. You know, you get out there and you look on Google and it says, oh, you ought to do this. Well, this has investment implications. Now, what is interesting about this is talking about the Wall Street Journal doing a big investigation on this. And of course, when the Wall Street gets, that's a pretty big newspaper.
It is.
And a lot of people pay attention to it. So this could have impact down the line when it comes to regulation. And it may not necessarily be bad in this particular area because of the amount of money involved and because of the impact on our economy. And I'll talk about that in just a second. It's fascinating. Google executives have said repeatedly, says the article in the Wall Street Journal, and the article, if you want to read it yourself, how Google interferes with its search algorithms and changes your results. This is in this week's journal. It may have been yesterday. But in private meetings, with Google says with outside groups in congressional testimony that the algorithms are objective and essentially autonomous, unsullied by human biases and business considerations. So, you know, just computer programmed itself, Tony.
Well, that sounds it.
I didn't. Yeah, okay. I'll just let you decide whether that's the case. But that message often clashes with what happens behind the scenes. Over time, Google has increasingly re-engineered and interfered with the search results to a far greater degree than the company and its executives have acknowledged the Wall Street Journal investigation has found. The actions have often come in response to pressure from businesses, outside interest groups, and governments around the world. And you can only imagine the pressure. When you're talking about billions of dollars.
Yep.
I mean, think about that.
Follow the money.
I remember having a guy, we were talking in his business. And all of a sudden, his business, which was raging hot, doing phenomenal, dropped off just like that. And it was computer related. It wasn't Google related. I'm going to tell you that. But it just shows you what a big deal it was. Here's a guy making about $500,000 a year down to one-tenth of that.
Oh, my.
I mean, literally, that's what happened to this poor guy. Message often clashes with what happens behind the scenes. And it says that the journal found that they have increased sharply. This pressure has increased sharply since the 2016 election and the rise of online information. Google's evolving approach marks a shift from its founding philosophy of, quote, organizing the world's information, to that which is more active in deciding how that information should appear. So, in essence, what happens is, let's say that you do a search, and you decide that your search is going to be, and this is one of the examples they gave someplace, it was a chart that I actually saw. And they actually complete your searches. So maybe you put the two words Trump is or Biden is, and you put that in a search engine. How is that phrase completed? Well, it differs based on the search engine you're using. So they'll give you things that you can look for, things that they think you're looking for. Well, if people are typically looking for the same things, the phrases should complete the same way regardless of which search engine.
Yeah.
You know? So Joe Biden is, if you did it in Google, it would say, he's done. Joe Biden is done. Or Joe Biden is how old? Or Joe Biden is, I don't know what the Democrat has said. It was kind of weird. But it was, Democrat, done, Google. If you went to DuckDuckGo, it was Joe Biden is, it's more caustic, is an idiot, is creepy, is a moron. It was totally different, totally different feel. And then you have, Trump is, if you put that in there. And one of the weird ones, Google, a horse in a hospital. What? Trump is a horse in a hospital? Then it said 46th president, and he's actually the 45th president. So that was actually wrong. And then the president's song or something like that, which I thought was a weird response. And then if you put it in DuckDuckGo, it was, he's a moron, he's an idiot, he's the Illuminati confirmed, that type of thing. But they said that Google had made algorithmic changes to its search results in favor of big businesses over smaller ones. Now, this is the one, this is where it has investment in implications, folks. You think about it. What percentage, and I don't know the answer to this, I think it's like over 50% though, what percentage of Americans are actually employed by small business? And I think it may be over 50%.
Over 50, yeah.
It's very, very high.
Yeah.
It's very, very high. But here's what's interesting is they made algorithmic changes to the search results in favor of big businesses over smaller ones, according to the Wall Street Journal. And in at least one case, made changes on behalf of a major advertiser. So you can imagine an advertiser that's got big bucks, deep pockets, is going to have some influence on what searches come up first, A. But B, think about it this way. If you look at what has happened over the past, 5 years, now certainly not over the last 20, because if you look at the last 20, large U.S. stocks have had the lowest return out of all asset categories. But large U.S. stocks in the past 5 have had the highest returns, but in the past week, in a few weeks, it has not been the case. Smaller companies have been actually outperforming. And the market will always respond to this information and price it in. But what if part of the reason for the underperformance of smaller companies and value companies over the past 5 years as a result of
algorithms.
Yeah. Think about that, the investment implications. And think about it, what if, what I'm screaming to you right here is why diversify? Must be broadly diversified, because what could happen here? I could see the government coming in and going, you know what, there's a problem here. We got a problem, and we've got too much control in the search engine on what companies get business, and we are going to change that, and we've got to level the playing field. And then all of a sudden, you're that person that's all caught up in this large U.S. stock portfolio that's selling for well over $3 for every dollar book value right now. That's what large U.S. stocks are selling for. And then all of a sudden, international small companies, which are selling for 70 cents on the dollar right now, are all of a sudden more benefited from, or U.S. small companies selling for $1.20,
right,
are all of a sudden more benefited by this information. And you don't know when this is going to happen. I mean, you talk about capricious. You look at the government coming and say, hey, look, we're going to change rules.
And again, this is legal it may not be ethical.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And there's not a legality, but how will the government deal with it? I mean, my question is, how would they come in and say, okay, we need to make a change because this is an ethical issue? Do they come in and say, we've got an ethical issue? Can they break up a company due to ethical issues?
I doubt that.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, that's me.
But they could change how the algorithm is fed information.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see how they would deal with that. So I think from an investing standpoint, it has some interesting implications. Now, one of the things that they said in the article, which I thought was fascinating, says businesses, lawmakers, and advertisers are worried about fairness and competition within the markets where Google is a leading player, and as a result, its operations are coming under heavy scrutiny. And this may be a partial answer to the question that I just brought up, but it says U.S. Justice Department earlier this year opened an antitrust probe in which Google's search policies and practices are expected to be an area of focus. Google executives have twice been called to testify before Congress over concerns over political bias. And in the European Union, they have actually been fined. So maybe that's how you control behavior to some extent. They were fined more than $9 billion, with a B, in the past 3 years for anti-competitive practices, including allegedly using its search engine in favor of its own products, says the Wall Street Journal. And basically what's going on, and I'll leave this segment with this right here, because I think this is fascinating. Because you could see why some of I'll save it for the next segment, because this is going to be a little too long, and it's too interesting to just leave for a couple seconds, because there could be some good reasons for some controlling the search results that you may not think about. I'm just going to make you wait for it. Going to be right back after this. You're listening to the Investor Coaching Show right here on Super Talk 99.7 WTN. Here, Investor Coaching Show. Paul Winkler, along with my friend Tony Bouquet from American College Financial Services.
He made y'all wait for this. He also made me wait for this.
I did. He asked me in the break. So I don't know. He's exactly sure. You're going to have to wait now, buddy. So it does get into how the algorithms are done, which is actually pretty interesting because, they actually. When you look at what's happening here in terms of how information is being held, and in essence what they're talking about, this article in the Wall Street Journal, is how Google is the article title is how Google interferes with its search algorithms and changes your results. And it can have an impact on financial markets, of course, because if they're actually benefiting bigger companies versus smaller companies, that has a negative impact. And they had a guy that they were actually talking to, and one of his employees came into him and says, hey, look, our purchases went down X percent. We have a huge drop in purchases, and I don't know what's going on. He's panic-stricken over the whole deal. And this is, you can literally kill a company in a heartbeat with this. Well, they gave it an example. This is at one extreme, the decisions at Google are made by the world's most complicated and highest paid engineers, whose job is to turn the dials within millions of lines of complex code. And the other is an army of more than 10,000 contract workers who work from home and get paid by the hour to evaluate search results, which I thought was fascinating.
That's interesting.
Isn't that interesting? The ranking supplied from the contractors who work from Google manual that runs to hundreds of pages can indirectly move a site higher or lower in results. So it's a zero-sum game. If you're moved higher, if somebody's moved higher, then by definition, everybody else has moved lower, is really what happens. And you look at this and go, okay, so is there any good reason for some of this stuff happening besides from a monetary standpoint? And yes, it turns out there actually is. There can be good reasons for it. According to people familiar with the matter, there are collective responses are measured by Google executives and used to affect the search algorithm. So they have all these people working hourly contract workers, and they take the information, they bring it back to these engineers that put in the algorithms, right? One of the evaluators, Zach Langley, now 27-year-old logistics manager at a tour company in New Orleans, Mr. Langley got a one-year contract in the spring of 2016, evaluating Google's search results through Lionbridge Technologies, one of several companies Google and other tech platforms use for contract work. During his work as a contractor, Mr. Langley said he never had any contact with anyone at Google, nor was he told what his results would be used for. Like all Google evaluators, he signed a non-disclosure agreement, made $13.50 an hour, and worked up to 20 hours a week from home. So basically working in his pajamas, they said. He says he was given hundreds of real search results and told to use his judgment to rate them according to quality, reputation, and usefulness amongst other factors. So you got these guys $13.50 an hour deciding who's going to be ranked in some cases here. Now, this is where it gets interesting, because you talk about how do you use this. At one point, Mr. Langley said he was unhappy with the search results for, get this search, the best way to kill myself. I mean, that was literally what he was evaluating, that search result. And what he was looking for is what was turning up. And what he found, you know what he found coming up, were how-to manuals. And this is where Google stepped in, to their credit. And in essence, what he did is he downranked all the other results for suicide until the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline was the number one result. This can be a big deal.
It can.
You know, so some of it's financial. And from an investing standpoint, this could have a definite impact. And you can see, you know, why larger companies have basically benefited under the regime of, when I say regime, I don't mean like political regime, but under how the company's been operated so far and what people tend to do, how people tend to use the internet. But you can see how regulation could change that in a heartbeat. And the thing you learn from it here is this: don't walk away from diversification as an investor. Just because one area of the market's doing better doesn't mean something won't change in a heartbeat real soon. PaulWinkler.com is the website. Paul Winkler, Investor Coaching Show on SuperTalk 99.7 WTN. Hey, this is Paul Winkler. Hope you enjoyed this week's edition of the Investor Coaching Show. If you want to learn more about what we do, go to our website, paulwinkler.com. You can watch some of the videos there. And if you're not already a client, you can set up a free initial consultation. Till next week, I'm Paul Winkler, reminding you that I believe that educated investors are more confident investors, and confident investors are more successful investors. Have a great one.